odd science. Comparing rates of pollution in different areas, detection levels were sometimes set high in the one and low in the other. In a 2005 study of the Calcasieu estuary, Louisiana state scientists inexplicably concluded that it would be dangerous for children aged 6 to 17 to swim in estuary waters, but not dangerous for children 6 and under. Such reports were also nearly unreadable. One typical report read, "Analyses reported as non-detects were analyzed using method detection limits that were higher than the comparison values used as screening tools." Sometimes the state simply lowered standards of protection. In an astonishing example of this, the Louisiana State Department of Health and Human Science offered advice to officials in other state agencies on what to tell the public about which fish are safe to eat. Issued in February 2012, and still online as of May 5, 2016, the report was written by one set of state officials for another. After a chilling description of a cancer slope factor, the report continues in a matter-of-fact tone to advise the recreational fishermen on how to prepare a contaminated fish to eat. Trimming the fat and skin on finfish and removing the hepatopancreas from crabs will reduce the amount of contaminants in the fish and shellfish, the document reads. Baking, broiling, and grilling are good, it said, because the fat drains away from the fish and shellfish. Discard juices which contain the fat to further reduce exposure, it says. Some contamination, like mercury and other heavy metals, however, are pervasive in the edible fish tissue, the report continues, in scientific deadpan prose, and remain in the fish and shellfish even after cooking. The report was shocking, but it also made a certain grim sense. If the companies won't pay to clean up the waters they pollute, and if the state won't make them, and if poverty is ever with us, some people need to fish for their dinner. Well, then, trim, grill, and eat mercury-soaked fish. At least the authors of the protocol were honest in what was a terrible answer to the great paradox. You got a problem? Get used to it. Mike Schaff had heard nothing of this advice, but when I describe it, he shakes his head. There it is again, more bad government. Why raise salaries? Take Steve Schultz, who heads our Department of Natural Resources. When he first went to work for me and other Louisiana taxpayers, he started at $30,000. Probably bought himself a mobile home or efficiency apartment his family could fit in. Then he got raises and moved to some fancy subdivision. Say we increase the budget for environmental protection. His salary rises from $150,000 to $190,000. The more money we give him, the more reason he has to be a yes man to Jindal and oil. To me, a public servant who doesn't make very much is more likely to be dedicated to what he's doing. Mike's idea of dedication was modeled on the church. On another visit, Mike had driven me in his red truck to the Catholic grade school he'd attended, across the street from the Catholic church where he had been confirmed, and next to a graveyard where his parents and maternal grandparents lay buried. He recalled the nuns instructing him to clap the blackboard erasers on the sidewalk. God would reward him if he did, but he remarked in passing, "The nuns were great teachers and lived very modestly. I think all public servants ought to be like those nuns." They wouldn't need much tax money, but he realized that the incentives to enter public service would be almost nil, making it hard to attract the best people. And on yet another visit, he confessed, "I could never live like they do." Thinking over the Bayou Corn disaster, I was still puzzled. Mike embraced a free market world because he wanted to preserve community. But did a total free market world and local community go together? And in essence, wasn't Louisiana already like a society based on a near pure free market? Governor Jindal advocated the free market and small government. Mike had voted for him on those very grounds. He had cut public services, lowered funds for environmental protection, and installed pro-industry protectors. The state hadn't functioned to protect the residents of Bayou Corn at all, and in the minds of some, had even absorbed the main blame for the sinkhole, just as Lee had absorbed the blame for PPG's pollution of Bayou Din. Having explored all the places the great paradox had taken me, from the 4,000-feet-deep storage vaults in the Napoleonville Salt Dome to the advice of state officials to recreational fishermen on how to prepare mercury-laced fish, I thought I was looking at an open-and-shut case for good government. But my new friend saw in this advice on how to prepare a contaminated fish an open-and-shut case for less government. I had criticisms of the federal government myself. Over-surveillance, the declaration of war in Iraq, letting off Wall Street speculators behind the 2008 crash, for example. But my criticisms were based on a faith in the idea of good government. Mike lands his boat at his dock and we return to his dining room table. He has told me that we don't need Social Security or Medicare.
Take Social Security. If you and I hadn't had to pay into it, he told me, we could have invested that money ourselves. Even given the 2008 downturn, you and I would be millionaires by now.
We didn't need the Federal Department of Education, he thought. That could go to each state. Or the Department of the Interior. We could privatize most public land. But hadn't Texas Brine just treated the public waters of Bayou Corn as if the company privately owned them? Did Mike want more of that? I was feeling stuck way over on my side of the empathy wall, so I turned my question around. What has the federal government done for you that you feel grateful for? He pauses.
Hurricane relief.
He pauses again.
The I-10,
a federally funded freeway. Another long pause.
Okay, unemployment insurance.
He had once been briefly on it. I suggest the Food and Drug Administration inspectors who check the safety of our food.
Yeah, that too.
What about the post office that delivered the parts of that Zenith 701 you assembled and flew over Bayou Corn's sinkhole to take a video you put on YouTube?
That came through FedEx.
The military in which he enlisted as an ROTC officer?
Yeah, okay.
Another pause. And so it went. We don't need this, we don't need that. Other interviews went the same way, with the same long pauses. How about the 44% of the state budget that comes from Washington, D.C.? Mike searches his mind.
Most of that goes for Medicaid, and at least half of the recipients, maybe more, aren't looking for work.
Do you know any? I ask.
Oh, sure, he answers, and I don't blame them. Most people I know use available government programs, since they paid for part of them. If the programs are there, why not use them?
On another visit, Mike recounted a near accident and rescue. He was taking his new bride and her two daughters on a boat ride when a powerful storm came up, his motor quit, and the boat rocked heavily.
First, the girls screamed with delight. Then they got quiet. We almost capsized. Luckily, the Coast Guard saw us and towed us to shore. I was glad to see him, Mike said, adding, he did check if we had safety vests, which I guess is okay.
What image of the government was at play? Was it a nosy big brother? the Coast Guard had checked for safety vests? Was it a remote-controlling Big Brother? A federal instead of state Department of Education? A bad parent playing favorites? Affirmative action? An insistent beggar at the door? Taxes? It was all of these, but something else, too. Just as Berkeley hippies of the 1960s felt proud to be above consumerism, to demonstrate their higher ideals of love and world harmony, even though they often depended on the parental money they were above, so too Mike Schaff and other Tea Party advocates seemed to be saying, "I'm above the government and all its services," to show the world their higher ideals, even though they used a host of them. For everything else it is, the government also functions as a curious status-marking machine. The less you depend on it, the higher your status. As the sociologist Thorsten Veblen long ago observed, our distance from necessity tends to confer honor. I count all the reasons Mike disdained government. It displaced community. It took away individual freedom. It didn't protect the citizenry. Its officials didn't live like nuns. And the federal government was a more powerful, distant, untrustworthy version of the state government. Beyond that, Mike was surrounded by a local culture of endurance and adaptation. If fish have mercury, cut around the dark meat and eat the white. It was this culture of adaptation that Mike himself would later challenge, as we shall see. But something else animated Mike's dislike for the government, something I was to discover wherever I went. Sometimes talk of it was angry, front and central. Sometimes it was quietly alluded to. But over their heads, the federal government was taking money from the workers and giving it to the idle. It was taking from people of good character and giving to people of bad character. No mention was made of social class, and enormous care was given to speak delicately and indirectly of blacks, although fear-tinged talk of Muslims was blunt. If the flashpoint between these groups had a location, it might be in the local welfare offices that gave federal money to beneficiaries. Louisiana Head Start, Louisiana Family Independence Temporary Assistance Program, Medicaid, the National School Lunch and Breakfast Program, the Special Supplemental Nutrition Program for Women, Infants, and Children. Liberals were telling Americans to feel sorry for recipients, but those were coastal, urban liberals trying to impose their feeling rules on older Southern and Midwestern Christian whites. And they seemed to be on the other side. So I wondered, did some of the malaise I was seeing derive from a class conflict, appearing where one least expected it, in the realm of government? And between groups, the middle blue-collar class and the poor, that liberals weren't focusing on? Was this a major source of resentment fueling the fire of the right? And in that fight, did the entire federal government seem to them on the wrong, betraying side? Maybe this was the main reason Mike was later to tell me, in reference to the 2016 presidential election, and only half-jokingly, that he could never bring himself to vote for the Menshevik, Hillary Clinton, or the Bolshevik, Bernie Sanders. As I leave, Mike hands me the jar of peaches that had been on the table when I arrived. I drive back up Crawfish Street, past tilting yards, onto the potentially sinking only exit route, and wonder, what news of Bayou Corn, federal regulations, handouts, and much else he received from church or from his favorite television channel, Fox News. 8. The pulpit and the press. The topic doesn't come up. In the first 10 minutes after meeting Madonna Massey for coffee at the Lake Charles Starbucks, I notice how many people seem happy to see her.
Hi, Madonna, you look beautiful today.
Well, thank you, Mr. Godet, you're looking well yourself.
Hi, Madonna, beautiful singing the other night.
Thank you, Joey, how's your daughter doing?
She wears a flowing floral skirt, and a mass of blonde curls cascades to one side of her lacy jacket. She has an easy, friendly manner, a lilting laugh, and a wide smile that seems to cast a circle of warmth around her. I had first met Madonna at a gathering of the Republican Women of Southwest Louisiana, where she told me she was a great devotee of the conservative radio talk show host Rush Limbaugh.
Oh, I follow the Rush doctrine, she'd said, especially what he says about feminazis.
Imagining she'd be interesting to talk to, I'd asked if we could meet for coffee. Upholding the right-leaning culture that surrounded me now was a social terrain. I had explored industry and the state. But what of the church and the press? Mike Schaff had defended his beloved community against the encroachment of government. Did others feel the same about the church? Were my new Louisiana friends defending an honored sphere? Or, independent of that, did the church promote personal values that might resolve the paradox I was exploring? Nearly everyone I met in Louisiana goes to church. Harold and Annette Areno attend the Lighthouse Tabernacle Pentecostal Church. Harold Areno's niece, Janice, meets Sundays with a small band of non-denominational Christian worshipers awaiting divine guidance before choosing their next pastor. Lee Sherman, who had pushed the tar buggy to the water's edge near Bayou Din, attends a Mormon church. Bob Hardy, the mayor of Westlake, attends a Catholic church. Mike Tritico quit one church, tried another, and now conducts Bible study with the Arenos, or on his own, in his disheveled cabin in Longville, and he attends a nearby Baptist church sing-along for the lively accordion gospel music. Yet another Lake Charles survivor of a desperate childhood would tell me that Sunday was her favorite day. A black Baptist minister in Crowley gently cautions a devoted all-black following against patronizing payday lenders. As a twice-divorced Catholic, Mike Schaff declines Sunday services, but from his 20s on has attended a yearly Jesuit retreat where he keeps 2 days of total silence, occasionally sneaking a quick iPhone text. Some go to church twice a week and meet for Bible study, too. People speak of children not as going to church, but as being churched. And this is said with the same pride as others might say, highly educated or well-mannered. Church in Louisiana, usually Baptist, Catholic, Methodist, or Pentecostal, is a pillar of social life. In Donaldsonville, population 7,000, the nearest big town to the home Mike Schaff was born in, churchfinder.com reports 11 Baptist churches, 4 Methodist, 4 Catholic, and 1 described as spirit-filled. To the west, some 108 miles, Lake Charles, with its population of 70,000, has 100 churches, mostly Baptist and spirit-filled, 57, but also Pentecostal, 12, and Catholic, 13. That's a church for every 700 people. Some buildings hold 1,000 worshipers, others a few dozen. By comparison, my hometown of Berkeley, California, a city of 117,000, has 82 churches, one for every 1,423 residents. Berkeley has 8 synagogues, Lake Charles has 1, and Donaldsonville, none. Around Lake Charles, God seemed in the air everywhere. Prayers were said before private meals and usually in public meetings before the flag salute.
church was in childhoods.
I went to church twice a week when I was a boy, and every day during revival, Harold Arino recalled of his youth in Bayou Din.
It was in business. At the Lake Charles Chamber of Commerce banquet at the Golden Nugget Casino, for example, board chairman Glenn Bertrand found himself in a decidedly secular setting. But speaking of the great $84 billion investment in the region, he said,
I hope that we recognize our economic successes as a blessing from above.
Church as emotional world. At 7:05 on a Thursday evening, Glenn Massey, Madonna's husband, is walking the aisles of Living Way Pentecostal Church, chatting with congregants, waiting for men to get off their shifts at the plants. I am sitting in the front row on the right, next to Madonna. It is where she usually sits, with her mother in the row behind. Both are accomplished gospel singers. Outside, parishioners are parking their SUVs, tucking in shirts, combing hair, and walking from the parking lot toward an extended hand or the hugging arms of greeters in the foyer of the church.
Good to see you. Glad you could make it.
By 7:15 p.m., some 700 worshipers are settled in their seats. As Pastor Glenn Massey speaks, gentle piano music runs beneath his words about how the Lord smoked my spirit. His eyes are closed. His arms rise. His hands swivel and wave in gestures of drawing closer to God. After Pastor Glenn's words, his speaking in tongues, in direct communication with God, Pentecostals believe, parishioners come forward to assistant pastors who are ready to receive them. One woman bows in a posture of despair. Another flutters her hands as if freeing them of something dreadful. Dressed in military fatigues, a man stalks slowly back and forth below the edge of the dais, as if to protect the troubled worshippers or to calm an inner anxiety of his own. Every human emotion is on display. Facing the worshippers, assistant ministers lay hands on a head, a shoulder, an arm, firmly, for a period of time, with a gentle shake as if to loosen a spirit. Others in the congregation come forward to lay hands on a person's back or arm, and still others lay hands upon those who have laid hands. Human layer upon layer, forming a momentary still life of human connection. At the end of the service, Pastor Glenn asks everyone who needs to forgive or be forgiven to come forward. Over half the congregation comes forward. When a certain time has passed, there is sighing, sometimes weeping, pats, and release. Plant workers slowly rise, shake hands, hug, chat briefly, and return to their pickup trucks and SUVs to head home. Living Way focuses on human healing. The needs it fills seem like those met in less religious cultures by psychotherapy and meditation, as well as by family and friendship. Other churches, such as Trinity Baptist, a megachurch in Lake Charles, add a focus on help for the less fortunate. Parishioners have organized a food drive for Abraham's Tent, a local food pantry and soup kitchen. Bulletin boards in other church hallways feature photos of groups of smiling African children lined up in their Sunday best in front of foreign church mission stations. Trinity Baptist has ministries in Ecuador, Africa, Peru, and Honduras, where they send 24 doctors, nurses, and dentists each year and host Vacation Bible School for children. A group from Trinity goes door to door sharing the gospel in Zimbabwe. Through her church, one woman organized a one-touch pillow campaign, sending hundreds of soft pillows to American soldiers in Iraq and Afghanistan. They are young, away from home, scared, she told me. But when a soldier's head touches this pillow, he knows he's in touch with God.
Still other churches organize bands of prayer warriors who gather to pray on behalf of those in trouble. Baptist, Pentecostal, Catholic, and all the churches I visit also meet needs beyond the spiritual, in a way that avoids the indignity that my Tea Party friends link with things public. Trinity Baptist Church provides a large fitness center with stationary bicycles and muscle-strengthening machines. The mother-in-law of a Lake Charles congregant lost 50 pounds in the church fitness center. Her two children, when younger, loved to coast down a giant slide that began on one floor and descended to a recreation room on the floor below, where they discovered a brightly colored, soft-sculpted octopus, whale, shark, alligator-piloted airplane, and giant seagull. For older children at Trinity Baptist, a snack bar and social lounge were open on Sundays, and a church camp during summers. It held Celebrate Recovery meetings for former addicts, sponsored its own sports teams for 8th through 12th graders, and had golf tournaments for the older set. Churches typically ask parishioners to tithe, to give 10% of their income. For many, this is a large sum, but it is considered an honor to give it. They pay taxes, but they give at church. The Trinity giant slide reminded me of the imaginatively designed Dolores Park in the Mission neighborhood of San Francisco and the public programs offered by the San Francisco Recreation and Parks Department. On my side of the empathy wall, public services and programs were an almost entirely positive thing. I thought of the San Francisco's Girls' Choir, and the teen musical theater that performs Fiddler on the Roof, for which middle school students get free acting and voice coaching. San Francisco provides funds for local artists to paint murals on forgotten underpasses. There are exercise classes, acro yoga, hooping, handstands, partner flip. The city sports leagues include softball, basketball, and tennis. Then there are cooking, hiking, poetry slamming, square dancing, and lakeside summer camps you have to sign up for very early. The lessons and camp cost something, but the city offers needs-sensitive scholarships. City-sponsored volunteers clean off graffiti, maintain hiking trails, plant trees, and become children's walk guides in the botanical garden. Mobile Rec takes a mobile rock climbing wall around the city. Greenagers is a program for 9th and 10th graders to improve green spaces. Such programs are open to people of all races and creeds, filling the same cultural space, it occurs to me, filled by the church programs I was discovering in Lake Charles. Silicon Valley's Google, Facebook, and Twitter, like many companies around the country, offer on-site services that bring workers inside their commercial doors. Google offers its employees breakfast, lunch, and dinner, including on weekends, as well as on-site fitness centers, massages, napping pods, medical care, and car detailing. This offers a much-desired private sector social world, one partly based on a different worship, work. Church as moral world. Madonna Massey recently moved to Lake Charles from Mississippi, so she is unfamiliar with the Arenos ordeal at Bayou Din or the lawsuit in which they were hoping for victory. She'd heard about the Bayou Corn sinkhole and shakes her head at that. Madonna has read articles in the local American press about structural problems in the I-10 bridge. "It spooks me out," she says. "Something about that bridge I don't like." But she'd read nothing in the paper, nor heard anything on Fox News about a spill of EDC that was approaching the foundations of the I-10 bridge. "I am so for capitalism and free enterprise," Madonna tells me as we sip our sweet teas at a cafeteria. "I hate the word regulate. I don't want the size of my Coke bottle or type of light bulb regulated. The American dream is not due to socialism or the EPA.
Sure, I want clean air and water, Madonna adds, but I trust our system to assure it.
Government workers do that, the thought streaks through my head.
Still, in Madonna's worldview, it seems that one has the police to protect one's property, Rush Limbaugh to protect one's pride, and God to take care of the rest. Environmentalists want to stop the American dream to protect the endangered toad, she says. But if I had to choose between the American dream and a toad, hey, I'll take the American dream.
Others I spoke to also pose the same either-or scenario, the very one Paul Templet had challenged. Madonna was born in the non-dream town of Lake Providence, Mississippi, which Time magazine named as the poorest town in America. And she has since prospered beyond her wildest dreams. She is helping her husband build a much-beloved megachurch. A gifted gospel singer and mother of two, she has produced highly popular CDs with innumerable iTunes downloads, lives in a lovely house, and drives a white Mercedes. Church had helped bring Madonna the American dream, as it had for a good number in the congregation, it seemed. But there were rich churches and poor churches. About 10 to 15% of the congregation at Living Way is black, Madonna was happy to say. But Lake Charles is half black, so the numbers suggest, if not inequality, at least separation. With almost no exceptions, Lake Charles's mainly white churches are richer, and its mainly black churches are poorer. So if government were removed from the picture, and the church made a substitute for it, I wondered, wouldn't the churched world remain a highly unequal one? This isn't an issue Madonna engages. With God's help, she believes everyone can rise as she has, one person at a time, if one truly and completely allows God to strengthen one's resolve. The religious community appreciates the outdoors, I learn, but what do they have to say about keeping it clean? In a description on his church website, Pastor Jeffrey Ralston of First Pentecostal Church in Lake Charles notes, I grew up in the country. My brother and I rode horses for miles and fished every day. Associate Pastor Jared Grissom describes his hobbies as hunting, fishing in and around Louisiana, frogging. But there is no mention of the health of the habitats for these fish, game, and frogs. On the websites of 10 major churches in Lake Charles, I found no mention of activities concerned with the polluted environment around them. The National Association of Evangelicals is a voice for its 30 million members who make up a quarter of the American electorate, and a leading organization of the religious right with a political voice. This is true, too, of the Christian Coalition, which supported some 36 senators and 243 members of the House of Representatives, half of whom received a score of 10% or lower on the environmental scorecard of the League of Conservation Voters. In a startling 2006 PBS television show called Is God Green?, Bill Moyers tried to interview top leaders of the evangelical churches, including the Reverends Pat Robertson and Jerry Falwell, and the Christian activist Ralph Reed. All of them referred Moyers to their shared spokesman, Dr. Calvin Beisner, an adjunct fellow at the Acton Institute for the Study of Religion and Liberty, based in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Beisner, in turn, cited Genesis chapter 1, verse 28. Then God blessed them, and God said to them, Be fruitful and multiply, fill the earth and subdue it. Have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the birds of the air, and over every living thing that moves on the earth. Dr. Beisner said the Bible also sanctioned mountaintop removal, presumably by coal companies. If you're going to mine for precious metals, for fossil fuels, for anything else, you don't do that with a feather brush, Beisner tells Moyers.
I think the scriptures actually tell us about the wonderful things that we can do with metals. We're told of gold and silver and other such things. Those things require mining, and force is simply a scientific term for the application of energy to physical objects to bring about change. My simple point about Genesis 1:28 is that we cannot escape the force involved in the Hebrew word for subdue. The Acton Institute was founded to teach on and to favor a free market perspective, its website says, and it is financially supported by various corporations, including ExxonMobil. But within the evangelical church, a small number of green voices are rising, calling for care of the environment, creation care. In 2006, some 86 religious leaders signed a statement entitled Climate Change, an Evangelical Call to Action. A West Virginia-based coalition opposed to coal blasting established a group called Christians for Mountains. So, in the nation at large, a debate about the environment has begun, especially among the young. But I saw no hint of such a debate in my encounters with evangelical believers. Word from the Lake Charles pulpits seemed to focus more on a person's moral strength to endure than on the will to change the circumstances that called on that strength. The service offered a collective, supportive arena, it seemed, within which it was safe to feel helpless, sad, or lost. As in an hour of therapy, the individual drew strength from support in order to endure what had to be endured. The church had given comfort to Harold and Annette Areno. Another grief-stricken parishioner, the mother of an ill child living in the highly polluted town of Mossville, told me, "I don't know how I could have gotten through this without my church." As for altering the pollution, poverty, ill health, and other things that had to be endured, for many, that lay beyond the doors of the church. Like the Arenos and others, Madonna believes in the rapture. According to the Bible, "The earth will groan," she tells me, "and earthquakes, tornadoes, floods, rain, blizzards, strife will occur, and the earth is groaning." Drawing from the books of Revelation and Daniel, Madonna believes that within the next 1,000 years, gravity will release the feet of believers as they ascend to heaven, while non-believers will remain on an earth that will become as hell. Revelation 20, 4-20, Daniel 9, 23-27. After the rapture, the world will end for a time before Christ creates it anew and begins a new 1,000-year period of peace, Madonna explains. "So what should we do about the groaning earth?" I ask Madonna. "I want my 10 great-grandchildren to have a great planet," she replies. "But the earth may just not be here." She poses a question I myself wondered about. "The BP oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico? I don't know. Some would say, let it go." Then she adds, "I'm giving you my Bible answers. I'm not well educated." Madonna attended 2 years of Bible college in Mississippi and explains, "This is not what you'd learn at your university. But mine is a true belief." This belief offered her a graphic image of the creation of the earth in 7 days. It put the age of the earth at 6,000 years. The city of heaven, she told me, was a cube, 1,500 miles square, divided into 12 bejeweled stories, each 120 miles high, with gates, the largest one of pearls. Across the nation, many share these beliefs with Madonna. According to a 2010 Pew Research Center report, 41% of all Americans believe the second coming probably or definitely will happen by the year 2050. Images of the rapture that believers have posted on the internet
suggest a growing gulf between those who rise to heaven and those who stay on earth. In one image, svelte, well-dressed adults rise to a blue sky. Perhaps the rapture speaks to shared and understandable anxieties about an earthly economy, it occurs to me. For many congregants, well-paid, union-protected jobs through which a man could support a stay-at-home wife are gone for all but a small elite. Given automation and corporate offshoring, real wages of high school-educated American men have fallen 40% since 1970. For the whole bottom 90% of workers, average wages have flattened since 1980. Many older white men are in despair. Indeed, such men suffer a higher-than-average death rate due to alcohol, drugs, and even suicide. Although life expectancy for nearly every other group is rising, between 1990 and 2008, the life expectancy of older white men without high school diplomas has been shortened by 3 years. And truly, it seems, by despair. In their tough, secular lives, life may well feel like end times. But word from the pulpit also seems to turn concern away from social problems in Louisiana. Poverty, poor schools, pollution-related illness. Away from government help, and away from the great paradox. Media as anxiety producer. We are still drinking sweet teas at the cafeteria, and Madonna pokes at her cell phone to show me her Twitter feed, which reflects the list of sources of information she relies on. The Republican National Committee, Jeb Bush, Michael Reagan, Michelle Malkin, the National Review, the Drudge Report, Donald Trump. Then it continues with motivational quotes, Fox News, Debbie Phelps, the mother of Olympic swimmer Michael Phelps, and various Christian leaders. Madonna's car radio is tuned to Rush Limbaugh, her brave heart. As a powerful influence over the views of the people I came to know, Fox News stands next to industry, state government, church, and the regular media as an extra pillar of political culture all its own. Madonna tunes into Fox on the radio, television, and internet. Up in Longville, where few subscribe to cable, Mike Tritico told me he could tell who was watching Fox News by the tilt of rooftop aerials. "It's nearly all Fox," he said. Fox gives Madonna and others the news. It suggests what the issues are. It tells her what to feel afraid, angry, and anxious about. To some, Fox is family. One woman, a great reader who is highly attuned to world news, tells me she listens to Fox throughout the day. When she turns the ignition in her SUV, Fox News comes on. When she sits at her computer in her study at home, she tunes into Fox via a small television to the right of her monitor. At the end of the day, sitting in a soft chair next to her husband, before a large screen, she watches the 5 o'clock news on Fox. "Fox is like family to me," she explains. "Bill O'Reilly is like a steady, reliable dad. Sean Hannity is like a difficult uncle who rises to anger too quickly. Megyn Kelly is like a smart sister. Then there's Greta Van Susteren. And Juan Williams, who came over from NPR, which was too left for him, the adoptee. They're all different, just like in a family." Fox offers news and opinions on matters of politics, of course, but it often strikes a note of alarm on issues, diseases, stock market plunges, with little direct bearing on politics. All news programs address our emotional alarm systems, of course, but with talk of a terror mosque at Ground Zero, of the left's secret immigration plan to wipe traditional America off the face of the earth, of Obama's supposed release of the ISIS leader Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, of his supposed masterminding the massacre at Fort Hood, Fox News stokes fear. And the fear seems to reflect that of the audience it most serves, white, middle, and working-class people. During the series of police killings of young black men, Fox reporters tended to defend white police officers and criticize black rioters. It defended the right to own guns and restrict voter registration, and it continually derided the federal government. While many claimed to listen to various stations, one car repairman listened to Brigham Young University radio on Sirius XM, in the evenings they watched Fox, and it was often Fox News that was digested along with dinner. Sitting amidst his boxes near the sinkhole, Mike Schaff watches Bill O'Reilly and the rest of the Fox family for his main news, but routinely channel surfs to CNN, MSNBC, and CBS, with a special curiosity about how liberal commentators like Rachel Maddow describe Southern white conservatives.
"A lot of liberal commentators look down on people like me. We can't say the N-word. We wouldn't want to. It's demeaning. So why do liberal commentators feel so free to use the R-word? Redneck."
None of the people I talked to one-on-one, off and on, over 5 years, used the extreme language I heard on Fox. George Russell, a Fox commentator, spoke of the green energy tyranny. Business anchor Eric Bolling referred to the EPA as job terrorists who are strangling America. Fox News Business Network commentator Lou Dobbs commented in 2011 that, "As it's being run now, the EPA could be part of the apparatus of the Soviet Union." One woman's favorite commentator, Charles Krauthammer, compared the rise in EPA air quality standards to an enemy attack on America. Fox offers no less news on the environment than did CNN or CNBC, but its oratory was inflammatory. Yet the words tyranny, apparat, terrorist, and strangler did not come up in my talks with Tea Party embracers in Louisiana. We all intuitively filter the news ourselves. One well-read, enthusiastic member of the Tea Party relied mainly on Fox News to watch and the Drudge Report to read online. But she sometimes dipped into the liberal media, occasionally purchasing the Sunday New York Times, just for the arts section. The rest of the times, she said, "I throw away. It's too liberal to read." She was a devotee of Fox News, but, employed as a flight attendant, she sometimes found herself in foreign cities, flipping channels on the TV in her hotel. BBC, CNN, MSNBC. "CNN is not objective at all," she complains. "I turn it on for news, and what I get is opinion." "How can you tell straight news from opinion?" I ask. "By their tone of voice," she explains. "Take Christian Amanpour. She'll be kneeling by a sick African child or a bedraggled Indian, looking into the camera, and her voice is saying, 'Something's wrong. We have to fix it.' Or worse, 'We caused the problem.' She's using that child to say, 'Do something, America.' But that child's problems aren't our fault." The Tea Party listener felt Christiane Amanpour was implicitly scolding her. She was imposing liberal feeling rules about whom to feel sorry for. The woman didn't want to be told she should feel sorry for or responsible for the fate of the child. Amanpour was overstepping her role as commentator by suggesting how to feel. The woman had her feeling guard up. "No," she told herself in so many words, "that's PC. That's what liberals want listeners like me to feel. I don't like it. And what's more, I don't want to be told I'm a bad person if I don't feel sorry for that child." The social terrain around her, industry, government, church, media, lifted focus away from such a child's needs and from her own detachment from them. Again, I was backing into her deep story by exploring what it shut out. But all deep stories do that, and we all have deep stories. Secret News. Long after Lee Sherman had polluted Bayou Din, had fallen ill, and had been fired for absenteeism from his job, around the time he held up the "I'm the One" sign before a stadium of 1,000 angry fishermen, he had joined a small environmental group called Restore. In 1994, a 40-year-old pipeline between Condia Vista and the Conoco docks was discovered to have sprung a leak, slow and over many years, of EDC into the soil. Ill-protected cleanup workers had become sick. 500 of them had sued the company, and in 1997, with modest recompense, won their case. This was when the strange things had begun to happen. As Lee Sherman recalls, "We met in the den of Miss Bobby's in my house, some 8 of us. The Arenos were there, and Mike Tritico, but a school teacher and his wife joined later. At first they seemed helpful, but little things happened. One day he and I were asked to buy some things for the group. He wrote down and held the list, and on it were 2 GPSs. We got home with those, and people asked why we'd gotten them. He made it seem like I had bought them for myself with the group's money. I didn't say anything, but I didn't like it." Another day, Lee recounted, "That man came early and asked to use Miss Bobby's computer. That was the computer she used for the group's bookkeeping." Having left the room momentarily, Miss Bobby noticed the man quickly changing the page on the computer screen. Later, she discovered that he had downloaded spyware that copied her email onto his computer. At the next meeting, Miss Bobby confronted the man, and after an acrimonious parting, the group fell apart, never to reassemble. No one knew the man's intent or why things in this tiny environmental group had gone so awry. 10 years later, news of something called the Lake Charles Project surfaced. Wanting to stop troublemakers from helping workers bring more such lawsuits, Condia Vista had secretly hired a team to spy on Restore. Peter Markey, then manager of the Condia Vista's supply chain operations, admitted in sworn deposition that for $250,000, the company had hired spies to infiltrate Restore. The spies were Special Forces retirees who worked for a Maryland-based security firm. One investor in the security firm discovered company officials burning papers and became suspicious of wrongdoing. He took the unburned portion home and discovered among them files from the Lake Charles Project. What was that? When asked during his deposition what the group was hired to do, Markey replied, "It was a surveillance operation." Attorney Perry Sanders asked, "What was being surveilled?" "Environmental groups," Markey answered. Attorney Sanders, "When you say they were being surveilled, what do you mean by that?" Markey, "People go to the meetings and that type of thing." Attorney Sanders, "What sort of people would go to meetings? You talking about, like, undercover operatives?" Markey, "Yeah." Attorney Sanders, "Who knew about it?" Markey, "The president, probably the chief counsel." The spies had collected tax records, listened in on phone calls, and photographed the Lake Charles home of Mike Tritico's mother, where he stayed. When in 2008 news of the Lake Charles Project got out, it was through an investigative report by journalist James Ridgway, published in the left-leaning Mother Jones magazine, which none of my right-leaning friends in Louisiana had ever heard of. The local ABC affiliate television station, KPLC, broadcasted 4 programs, each a few minutes long, in the summer of 2008, in a series that began with Condia Vista Hired Spies. But the archives of the main newspaper in the area, the Lake Charles-based American Press, contain no mention of it. The New Orleans-based Times-Picayune reported on a lawsuit filed by Greenpeace in 2011, which mentioned the 2008 exposé in passing. But by 2011, when I began interviewing people in town, no one remembered the spy case. The environmental group had broken up, and Condia Vista was now called Sasol. As I reviewed the social terrain of the right-leaning people I had come to know, the companies, the state government, the church, Fox News, I reflected on my keyhole issue. Everyone I was talking to was enduring a great deal of pollution, and despite the silence from companies, politicians, and state officials, nearly everyone clearly knew it. To some, such as Lee Sherman and Harold and Annette Areno, exposure had become the defining experience of their lives. To others, it was a passing matter. While many, like Madonna Massey, spoke of their love of capitalism, the dominant industry in their economy presented a decidedly mixed story. Oil was highly automated and accounted for some 15% of jobs, and even some of those were going to foreign workers at lower pay. The state had made huge cuts to local jobs and social services in order to bring in companies, and instead of money trickling down, a third of it was leaking out. To some degree, the community had become the site of local production without being the site of local producers. They were victims without a language of victimhood. I felt like I was working slowly backward toward an answer to the great paradox, daily crossing and recrossing the empathy wall as I tried to stay focused on the viewpoints of my new friends. I started with problems, which was one side of the paradox. Many locals resisted this focus. Didn't I see how beautiful Louisiana was? Had I attended the Lake Charles Mardi Gras? Why such a gloomy focus? But I wasn't making these problems up. They were there. Pollution, health, schooling, poverty. Moving backward, if one admits a problem, one is obliged to admit to a desire to fix it. But who might fix the problem of pollution? Companies weren't volunteering. With regard to social support, churches lacked the mission and the money. Surprisingly, everyone agreed that if things were to be fixed, the federal government had to get involved. But if the federal government got involved, right-wing flags went up. It was too big, too incompetent, too malintentioned. So maybe it was back to structural amnesia. Why the big fuss? What was the big problem? Didn't other things matter more? ISIS, immigration, undeserving government beneficiaries? Who had led them to expect all they felt entitled to expect? The over half of Louisianans who were beneficiaries, as Mike Schaff pointed out. The fun-at-night gals on the dole Lee Sherman envisioned. The poor dears Bob Hardy saw around town. Sure, some people cheat the government, I thought, and that's wrong. But it is a very long leap between annoyance at cheaters and hatred of nearly all federal government. Why that leap? The best path to the root answer, I thought, was through their deep story. Part 3. The Deep Story and the People in It. 9. The Deep Story. Behind all I was learning about bayou and factory childhoods and the larger context, industry, state, church, regular media, Fox News, of the lives of those I had come to know, lay, I realized, a deep story. A deep story is A feels-as-if story. It's the story feelings tell, in the language of symbols. It removes judgment. It removes fact. It tells us how things feel. Such a story permits those on both sides of the political spectrum to stand back and explore the subjective prism through which the party on the other side sees the world. And I don't believe we understand anyone's politics, right or left, without it. For we all have a deep story. There are many kinds of deep story, of course. Lovers come to know each other's childhood in order to understand how it feels to be the other person. They learn a personal deep story. Foreign leaders and diplomats try to understand national deep stories in order to relate more effectively to world leaders. They gather international deep stories. The deep story here, that of the Tea Party, focuses on relationships between social groups within our national borders. I constructed this deep story to represent, in metaphorical form, the hopes, fears, pride, shame, resentment, and anxiety in the lives of those I talked with. Then I tried it out on my Tea Party friends to see if they thought it fit their experience. They did. Like a play, it unfolds in scenes. Waiting in line. You are patiently standing in a long line leading up a hill, as in a pilgrimage. You are situated in the middle of this line, along with others who are also white, older, Christian, and predominantly male, some with college degrees, some not. Just over the brow of the hill is the American dream, the goal of everyone waiting in line. Many in the back of the line are people of color, poor, young and old, mainly without college degrees. It's scary to look back. There are so many behind you, and in principle you wish them well. Still, you've waited a long time, worked hard, and the line is barely moving. You deserve to move forward a little faster. You're patient but weary. You focus ahead, especially on those at the very top of the hill. The American dream is a dream of progress, the idea that you're better off than your forebears, just as they superseded their parents before you, and extends beyond money and stuff. You've suffered long hours, layoffs, and exposure to dangerous chemicals at work, and received reduced pensions. You have shown moral character through trial by fire, and the American dream of prosperity and security is a reward for all of this, showing who you have been and are, a badge of honor. The source of the American dream is on the other side of the hill, hidden. Has the economy come to a strange standstill? Is my company doing okay? Will I get a raise this year? Are there good jobs for us all, or just a few? Will we be waiting in line forever? It's so hard to see over the brow of the hill. The sun is hot and the line unmoving. In fact, is it moving backward? You haven't gotten a raise in years, and there is no talk of one. Actually, if you are short a high school diploma, or even a BA, your income has dropped over the last 20 years. That has happened to your buddies, too. In fact, some of them have stopped looking for good jobs, because they figure for guys like them, good jobs aren't out there. You've taken the bad news in stride because you're a positive person. You're not a complainer. You count your blessings. You wish you could help your family and church more because that's where your heart is. You'd like them to feel grateful to you for being so giving to them. But this line isn't moving. And after all your intense effort, all your sacrifice, you're beginning to feel stuck. You think of things to feel proud of. Your Christian morality, for one. You've always stood up for clean living, monogamous, heterosexual marriage. That hasn't been easy. You've been through a separation yourself, a near or actual divorce. Liberals are saying your ideas are outmoded, sexist, homophobic. But it's not clear what their values are. And given a climate of secular tolerance, you remember better times, when as a child you said morning prayer and the flag salute, before Under God had to come out, in public school. The Line Cutters. Look, you see people cutting in line ahead of you. You're following the rules. They aren't. As they cut in, it feels like you are being moved back. How can they just do that? Who are they? Some are black. Through affirmative action plans, pushed by the federal government, they are being given preference for places in colleges and universities, apprenticeships, jobs, welfare payments, and free lunches. And they hold a certain secret place in people's minds, as we see below. Women, immigrants, refugees, public sector workers, where will it end? Your money is running through a liberal sympathy sieve you don't control or agree with. These are opportunities you'd have loved to have had in your day, and either you should have had them when you were young, or the young shouldn't be getting them now. It's not fair. And President Obama, how did he rise so high? The biracial son of a low-income single mother becomes president of the most powerful country in the world. You didn't see that coming. And if he's there, what kind of a slouch does his rise make you feel like? You who are supposed to be so much more privileged. Or did Obama get there fairly? How did he get into an expensive place like Columbia University? How did Michelle Obama get enough money to go to Princeton? And then Harvard Law School, with a father who was a city water plant employee. You've never seen anything like it, not up close. The federal government must have given them money. And Michelle should feel grateful for all she has, but sometimes she seems mad. She has no right to feel mad. Women. Another group is cutting ahead of you in line, if you are a man. Women demanding the right to the men's jobs. Your dad didn't have to compete with women for scarce positions at the office. Also jumping in line ahead of you are overpaid public sector employees, and a majority of them are women and minorities. It also seems to you that they work shorter hours in more secure and overpaid jobs, enjoying larger pensions than yours. That assistant administrator at the Department of Regulation has cushy hours, a fat pension awaiting her, lifetime tenure, and she's probably sitting at her screen doing online shopping. What has she done to deserve perks that you don't enjoy? Immigrants. And now, Filipinos, Mexicans, Arabs, Indians, and Chinese on special visas or green cards are ahead of you in line. Or maybe they snuck in. You've seen Mexican-looking men building the man camps that are to house Sasol's Filipino pipe fitters. You see the Mexicans work hard, and you admire that. But they work for less, and lower white American pay. Refugees. 4 million Syrian refugees are fleeing war and chaos, thousands a day appearing in boats on the shores of Greece. President Obama accepted 10,000 of them, two-thirds women and children, to settle in the United States. But word has it that 90% of the refugees are young men, possibly ISIS terrorists, poised to get in line ahead of you and get their hands on your tax money. And what about you? You've suffered floods, oil spills, and chemical leaks. There are days when you feel like a refugee yourself. The brown pelican. Unbelievably, standing ahead of you in line is a brown pelican, fluttering its long, oil-drenched wings. The Louisiana state bird, pictured on the state flag, nests in mangrove trees on ribbons of sand along the coast. The brown pelican was at one time nearly wiped out by chemical pollution. But in 2009, it was removed from the endangered species list, a year before the 2010 BP oil spill. To keep surviving, it now needs clean fish to eat, clean water to dive in, oil-free marshes, and protection from coastal erosion. That's why it's in line ahead of you. But really, it's just an animal, and you're a human being. Blacks, women, immigrants, refugees, brown pelicans all have cut ahead of you in line. But it's people like you who have made this country great. You feel uneasy. It has to be said, the line cutters irritate you. They are violating rules of fairness. You resent them, and you feel it's right that you do. So do your friends. Fox commentators reflect your feelings. For your deep story is also the Fox News deep story. You're a compassionate person, but now you've been asked to extend your sympathy to all the people who have cut in front of you. So you have your guard up against requests for sympathy. People complain. Racism, discrimination, sexism. You've heard stories of oppressed blacks, dominated women, weary immigrants, closeted gays, desperate refugees, but at some point you say to yourself, you have to close the borders to human sympathy, especially if there are some among them who might bring you harm. You've suffered a good deal yourself, but you aren't complaining about it. Betrayal. Then you become suspicious. If people are cutting in line ahead of you, someone must be helping them. Who? A man is monitoring the line, walking up and down it, ensuring that the line is orderly and that access to the dream is fair. His name is President Barack Hussein Obama. But, hey, you see him waving to the line cutters. He's helping them. He feels extra sympathy for them that he doesn't feel for you. He's on their side. He's telling you that these line cutters deserve special treatment, that they've had a harder time than you've had. You don't live near the line cutters, or have close friends in most categories of the line cutters, but from what you can see or hear on Fox News, the real story doesn't correspond to his story about the line cutters, which celebrates so many black people, women, and immigrants. The supervisor wants you to sympathize with the line cutters, but you don't want to. It's not fair. In fact, the president and his wife are line cutters themselves. You feel betrayed. The president is their president, not your president. Now you have your guard way up. Watch out for lies. Presidents and other officials often wear a small pin showing the American flag. A flag pin. Did you see what a small flag pin he is wearing today? Maybe that means he's not proud of America. So the great pride you feel in being an American cannot be conveyed through him. As a source of honor, being an American is more important to you than ever, given the slowness of this line to the American dream, and given disrespectful talk about whites and men and Bible-believing Christians. Obama's story seems fishy. You're not a paranoid type, but it seems to you that either the federal government funded Obama's education, or, even worse, secret strings were pulled. A friend of yours asks you whether or not you noticed that Obama took off his wristwatch for Ramadan. She is referring to a custom of removing jewelry during the Muslim holy month. He was brought up on the Quran, a neighbor says. You may not yet have the biggest house, but you can certainly be proud of being American. And anyone who criticizes America, well, they're criticizing you. If you can no longer feel pride in the United States through its president, you'll have to feel American in some new way, by banding with others who feel as strangers in their own land. Intermission. Meanwhile, for the white, Christian, older, right-leaning Louisiana